I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. The 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising is exactly a week from now, June 28th, when in 1969 the patrons of the Stonewall Inn rebelled against a police raid and lit the spark for the gay liberation movement. The patrons of the inn tended to be among the poorest and most marginalized in society and in the gay community. Queens and queers, feminine gay men and butch lesbians, transgender people. They were also the people who tended not to show up in the newspapers, because society would have preferred they didn't exist at all. But when queer existence was acknowledged, it was criminalized, and never so explicitly as in the true crime stories that exploded in popularity after World War I. Newspapers reported on the murder of men by other men in lurid detail and breathlessly repeated the suspect's defenses, that he was driven to violence by the victim's indecent advances, that the only normal response to homosexual desire was murder. Indecent Advances is the title of James Polchin's new book about how queer men were represented in true crime stories from the end of World War I to the Stonewall era. Newspapers were central to circulating ideas about what was normal and what was deviant, and the stories in the crime pages were weaponized against queer men in the sex panics of the 1930s and the Lavender Scare of the 1950s. But then, ultimately, this discrimination was turned on its head by early gay rights groups, known then as homophile groups, and transformed into a civil rights movement for a social minority. James Polchin is a clinical professor at New York University, and he joins us from Manhattan to talk about the book. Thanks so much for chatting with me, James.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you write in your introduction that, quote, queer history has often focused on narratives of progress in which sexual minorities prosper despite the social injustices done to them. And yours is not that kind of history. So where do you see Indecent Advances fitting into that narrative?
Right. No, I think definitely this is not a book about community development or cultural expression. But I think that, you know, there's always that background in those stories of a queer past. Those histories are very much about how queer citizens found cultural life, found community, despite all the prejudices, despite all the discriminations and dangers that they had to navigate. And so for me, I really wanted to investigate more of the kinds of dangers, the kinds of real violence that queer citizens faced, both on the streets, but also in the criminal justice system.
You know, your book is dark and oftentimes violent, but to me, it didn't really seem entirely hopeless because we begin with, you know, a lot of newspaper clippings of brutal murders, but we do end with the reversal, I guess, of how violence is treated by the community with the Harvey Milk murder or with Stonewall and people reacting to it and responding in an organized way.
Right, right. And that was definitely the arc of this story I wanted to tell, not simply a story of, or many stories of violence and murders against queer men who were clearly targeted by their killers, by their assailants, right? You know, I wanted to show how at the same time that the mainstream media, the legal structures were really discriminatory towards these kinds of crimes, I also wanted to show how they ultimately became really powerful tools to develop a sense of homosexuals as a social minority that suffered within the society and that deserved certain kinds of recognition as social minorities, right? And so while it's true, this book is filled with a number of crimes, and I really try to give the details the way the newspapers presented them, because I think it's really important that contemporary readers understand both the nature of the crimes, but also the nature of how the newspapers were reporting it. But there is that sense of evolution. There's that sense of early homophile civil rights groups in the 1950s turning to the crime pages and saying, this is evidence of how we are discriminated against. This is not evidence of our criminality. And so they reread those pages in a really powerful way, in a thoughtful way. And I think it's a really important part of how this emerging consciousness that homosexuals constitute a social minority.
Well, let's talk about the time frame that you're looking at, because in your book, you focus on the end of the First World War through the Stonewall Uprising, or really before it.
Right.
Why start in the 1920s when both newspapers and queer people were around long before then?
This is very true. You know, the 1920s is particularly post-World War I is really a kind of crucial moment. There had certainly been investigations and concerns about homosexuality before World War I, particularly in urban settings. But there's something about that moment in the early 1920s when homosexuality becomes a very big concern. I mean, that's putting it lightly, this kind of concern across psychology, criminology, and increasingly in the press, right? There's this moment, right, also in the 1919-1920 when sodomy is officially coded as a crime in the military. It's one sort of indication of how concern about the problem of homosexuality on the home front begins to take shape.
Can you expand on how homosexuality was defined and understood over the course of this period? Because it does change a lot, and it started somewhere, goes somewhere different, and then ends somewhere even completely different, you know, behavior versus inborn, yeah, and nature versus nurture, et cetera.
That's actually a fascinating thread of this, of the research and of the work, right? So I initially started to look at the crime stories, right? That's what my interest was, to uncover these crime stories. Most of them have never been read since they were first published. I didn't know about them, and I had many years of study into the history of sexuality, and these were not documents that I knew of. And so what came out of that, though, was this other story about the theories of homosexuality that threaded through criminology and medical professions at the time, right? And so you have these debates at the time, older models of homosexuality as a biological defect, right? Something that can be read on the body, something that you can point to and identify as a homosexual, right? And also part of that was this notion that it's a small minority of people who have this kind of biological defect. But then there's this other theory that comes about, which is about a mental defect, and mostly through a kind of Freudian lens in which childhood development was a big impact. And that was a very dominant kind of approach in the post-World War II period. But of course, coupled with that is notion that you can change, right? And so it brought about all kinds of psychological and medical practices to transform and to fix, basically, the problems of childhood for homosexuals. And then, of course, there is the very influential study that Alfred Kinsey did that came out in 1948 about male sexuality. And what he found was that homosexuality was pervasive across all kinds of classes and geographies and professions, and that it couldn't be located in any one kind of background or upbringing. It certainly couldn't be located in one kind of biological defect. So his theories were so impactful and changing and questioning those debates that were happening about the idea of the origins of homosexuality.
So, I mean, if these accounts were not something you'd encountered in the history of sexuality, how did you discover them? I mean, given that you wouldn't exactly find like queer murder or gay murder printed in the press.
Right, right. Newspapers were not indexing gay murders or queer crimes in this period. And so I initially started this research back in the dark days before newspapers were digitalized. And so I came across the journals of Carl van Vechten many years ago. Van Vechten was an artist and a writer. He was a big promoter of Harlem Renaissance writers in the 1920s. He was married twice. His second wife, he was married to her up until his death in 1964. But he also had a number of homosexual relationships and was known to have these relationships. So what he did in the later years of his life was compile these scrapbooks of queer life in those decades, I would say from the 1920s till the 1950s, drag ball flyers, advertisements for queer novels. He made his own kind of homoerotic collages from newspaper images and his own images. But mixed into all this ephemera were crime stories from the newspapers that he would clip. Many of them were coded. They weren't so explicit, but you could tell from where the two men met or the particulars of the murder itself that there was a queer subtext to them, and here they were in Van Vechten's scrapbooks. And so that was my first encounter with these kinds of stories, and it sort of set me off searching them. Once newspapers began to be digitalized, then it opened up ways of searching with key phrases, sailor found murdered in hotel room, for example. Those kinds of phrases opened up a whole bunch of articles I never would have found just by going through the microfilm.
Well, I mean, your book title is itself one of those coded phrases that was used by newspapers and also by a lot of the murderers themselves to reference homosexuality. So how were phrases like indecent advances used, and what were other ways that newspapers, reporters, even some of the perpetrators coded homosexuality?
The term indecent advances is a great one, right? It's so compelling. It's so it both tells you a lot, but then tells you nothing, right? It sort of is a term that is very provocative in that way. And so, yeah, the press would use this term, indecent advance. They'd also use improper advance. Later on in the 50s and that, it would even use terms such as homosexual advance, right? So it was very clear what was going on. And that was a way to code the kinds of interactions between the victim and the killer in these crime stories. And of course, it's a prejudice term, right? Because it really puts the blame on the victim. And so you had defendants using this kind of language in the courtroom to claim justifiable homicide, to claim a certain kind of defense, right? I had to protect myself from these advances of this homosexual. And of course, we have to remember that in the broader public imagination, homosexuality was associated with criminality. And increasingly, homosexuals were seen as violent threats. So those kinds of terms, indecent advance or improper advance, resonated and were really useful for defendants in the courtroom, because they did play on the prejudices of the juries and the court to often get them a lesser charge or acquit it completely.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most galling examples of that to me was this murder you talk about, the Kenneth Noy murders. He was known as the Singing Slayer, and he killed two men. The prosecution argued that it was totally, he was totally, here, actually, I'm going to let you explain what happened.
No, that's one of my favorite cases, and it's very complicated, right? So this was in 1933, and he met his first victim in Times Square. He went home with him to New Jersey, where the victim lived, and ended up violently beating and killing him. He then takes the victim's clothes and the victim's car. He drives to New Orleans, where he meets up with another man in a hotel room, an older man who's married with kids on a business trip, and he ends up also beating and strangling that man and killing him. Eventually, he is arrested, and he's extradited back to New Orleans to stand trial for the second murder. But in that trial, there was the question of sanity. Kenneth Newey was, the papers called him the killer crooner. And he had this real, you want to say, like a Hollywood gangster appeal to him. He was handsome. He sang. He tap danced. He was very engaging, definitely for press purposes, right? He also did these incredibly odd gestures where he was wearing the suit of one of his victims and the shoes of his other victims when he went to court. And so, you know, he might be, you know, thought of as a psychopath in our own terminology today. But in his trial in New Orleans, the prosecution was arguing that Newey was definitely sane. And a big part of the evidence for his sanity was that he reacted violently towards the indecent advance of his first victim. And that's something that he had claimed, like, I killed that first victim because he came on to me. In the courtroom, that was a big part of the prosecution's argument, that that confirms that he's a normal, sane man. And clearly the prosecution was playing to the prejudices of the jury, and as well as the press at the time. And so, you know, that kind of argument was really circulated in the New Orleans press.
Right. Yeah, I was struck by how often and how complicit I think that newspapers were in demonizing the victims of these crimes. In a lot of ways, at the end of the story, at the end of the trial, the victim looked worse and looked more criminal than the alleged criminal himself. So, I mean, how did the press sort of play along with that, or in fact originate that?
That's a great way of framing how these stories played out from initial crime report through to the trial reports, right? You know, I think the press was definitely eager for these stories at the time, right? They were competing often with True Crime Magazine, True Detective Magazine. These are also inventions of the 1920s. And so, you know, if you've ever looked at one of those magazines, they're just rich with dramatic language and mystery, right? And so I think these crime pages, particularly tabloids, began to really take on that interest in the entertainment of crime stories, and the shock value and the sensational value. That's a big part of how people, not only in cities, but, you know, with the AP wire service that was expanding in this period, these news stories that would happen in New York or Los Angeles or DC would circulate across the country to regional newspapers, to small town newspapers. And so the press was very vital, I think, in amplifying and circulating a notion of queer criminality across the country at the time. When, you know, you didn't see homosexuality in film, you didn't really see it in novels unless you were living in cities, because your local library wouldn't have such books.
So how do we get from that to the resistance of Stonewall? And later, how exactly does all this violence get turned on its head, or, you know, just seen differently and reacted to instead of just sitting there? It just seems like so much to combat.
Yeah, I mean, what I look at the end of this book is the early homophile civil rights groups in the 50s who really start to take on this notion. And it was a radical notion at the time, right? Because, again, sodomy was still illegal in every state. Queer men were still seen as criminals. This idea that homosexuals constituted a social minority was a completely radical idea and debated among early civil rights homophile groups, right, about this kind of position, this kind of argument. But I do think that the crime stories and how queer citizens were victimized on the streets, in the courtrooms, I think that was definitely a key element to motivate this notion of a social minority that needed rights, that needed a sense of a place in the larger society and not simply targeted, not simply criminalized in the ways that they had been, right? And it also, of course, comes right at the time that we had the Cold War scares of communism, we had the Lavender Scare, right? You have all these forces that are really amping up and targeting homosexuals as threats, as criminal elements across the spectrum of society. So I think, you know, there was that tipping point where we start turning around and thinking about the ways in which homosexuality has been talked about in the press. So that reading of those crime stories in a completely different way was vital.
They say that the arc of history bends towards progress. But the uptick in crimes against queer and trans and other marginalized people in the past few years testifies to the importance of the stories that James Polchin tells in Indecent Advances. And to the importance of taking care in the way that we tell stories about queer America, because the words and frameworks we use have a real impact on the public imagination. Just look at the way that bathrooms have been policed from the 1960s to today, or the way that someone's appearance is still used to justify lethal force. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.